That must have been a lot. Did you encounter a lot of jealousy of having won the Bendix and then that you won the Bendix and how this would try to think about that or capture that feeling of winning the Bendix, and you describe that over all those men. And then the absolute amazement of people that you won the Bendix, that you were the first.
Well, nobody was more surprised than you
was. I know, and that was part of the excitement, the lament where they, how did the men treat you? Whether they just were nice about it or congratulated you for it was great. Was it jealousy?
You mean the people in the race?
Yeah, they must have been absolutely.
I never did see any of them after either.
No?
It's just a totally impersonal thing.
It must have been a disappointment to
every man for
himself. To Amelia, you know, that film they showed in her life. Putnam says, you lost the Bendix, and he was always losing these things, and he was always being upset. She must have had a little more anxiety than other people, maybe. She had also this image to keep up.
Well, she was certainly a good sport. About it, you just can't win everything.
Well, I know, but she didn't very often win those big races, did she?
No.
To the pressure of Putnam. Well, I just wanted to go back again anyway, something I wanted to ask you about the Powder Puff Derby. So when Marvel Crossing died, that must put a damper on things, plus you had all that.
No, it didn't.
But you had all those charges of sabotage, didn't you? I mean, the people were claiming the victory, the sabotage.
Yeah, but even that didn't.
You just counted it and
shrugged it off.
Some people dropped out of the race because of that. Those are probably people who thought they might not win anymore.
Well, the people who dropped out because of mechanical problems.
It said in the paper that someone dropped out because they charged sabotage.
Well, I think there was some. But we were bound and determined. That it was going to be a good race. The whole objective of everybody was to make it a good race.
Yeah.
And we weren't separate entities racing against everybody else. We were a whole racing to Cleveland.
That's unusual. I mean, you know, that attitude.
And everybody helped everybody where they could. And there wasn't any bitter rivalry or a feeling of competitiveness. You were doing the best you could.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't say, aha, I beat her,
yeah.
You know, or anything. It was different from the men's races. I mean, they were cutthroaty and, you know, they'd do anything to them. But what we wanted to do was get everybody to Cleveland. And it isn't known, and I wouldn't like it said in the book, but we just broke all kinds of race rules in letting people who had motor trouble or something and got behind come on and join the race again when they should have been out of it.
That was terrific of you to do that.
Well, everybody, you know, we got together and agreed.
That's nice. I think that's wonderful. This is sort of the nobility again. You know, that was always that nobility and spirit that keeps popping up.
Yeah.
Women in aviation.
So a lot of people finished the race who should have been out of it.
That was nice, though. And that probably really, and it really promoted women. It helped promote women in aviation.
It
seems to me that was one of the main goals, always this concern with promoting women in aviation. So I want to get back to something else. We were talking about the men's attitude, and I wanted to combine this with the formation of the 99s. Marjorie Brown, Neva Paris, and Faye Wells were primarily, and Opal
Coombs
were primarily responsible for forming the 99th.
No, that isn't true.
It isn't?
Mm-mm.
Oh, I'd read, okay, who is the one?
Well, a couple of years, about 1927 or so, Amelia and Ruth Nichols, who lived in Rye, New York, and Amelia was up in that area during the settlement work before the Friendship Club. And they got to corresponding and finally met, and Amelia felt like that...
this is before Amelia went on the Friendship Club, you think?
Yeah. Suggested to Ruth that maybe it would be nice if the few women who flew could sort of have a club of some kind. And nothing came of it. And there was talk in several areas among different women pilots that it would be nice if we just, you know, you could have a club. But nothing ever came of that. And the 29 Derby served as a catalyst to the organization of a club. And we got to talking about it during the Derby, and then during the races in Cleveland, most of the Derby pilots got together under a tree back of the grandstand one afternoon and said, well, let's go ahead and try to get organized. Then, because there were more women pilots around the New York area than there were around any other area in the country, the gals there picked it up, and started doing some of the old kind of riding around saying, shall we, and stuff. And I was living in Pittsburgh at the time, and I went over a couple of times and talked to Amelia and Ruth. And out of all of that, finally evolved the 99s. And I wouldn't say, really, that anybody, you couldn't put a finger on who started it. You really couldn't. There are a lot of people who say certain people did, but not really.
Then Clara Studer sent out letters or something to...
Well, that was part of the kind of feeler
that
went out. And it was Clara who did it because she was with Curtis Wright and had the facilities to do it.
There was an article in the paper in the Times that said that... Sorry, you had time to put things along a bit. That there was a meeting to plan a women's organization for women's pilots at Opal Coombs' apartment with Neva Paris, going to be called the 86.
Yeah, well, that was really the first real organizational meeting, was that meeting at Opal Coombs' house.
Oh, and then after Clara had sent the flyers out, and they decided, and they'd gotten 86 responses at that time, I suppose, and that's why they were going to...
Yeah, well, we decided at that time that that an official letter would go out inviting all of the women pilots to join the organization. And we couldn't decide on a name, and we finally decided that the number of responses we got would be the name of the club, and with a certain postmark deadline. So it looked like it was going to be the 86ers, but enough came in after that with the postmark before the deadline, so it got to be 99.
Oh, and then you held your, after you held an organization meeting, and you had that big meeting out in, followed the big meeting out in Long Island.
Well, it wasn't a very big meeting, but that was a meeting, but it was after the Oprah Coons meeting.
For the 99th, Marjorie Brown writes about this great article about how much she felt inspired by the feeling of sex loyalty and comradeship of women because of the organization of the 99th and because of aviation. So the 99th helped crystallize that feeling amongst the women.
I think they probably did.
And
we operated for the first year while we were really getting organized with just two officers, with me as secretary and Blanche as treasurer. And then getting it set up.
What were the goals you had in mind, and what was the purpose for that stuff?
Oh, they were very simple.
Wasn't political?
Just to promote women in aviation as a just a kind of a social contact thing. But, I think the Constitution was about that long.
And the 99th helped with promoting women in aviation. I mean, that's where the game crystallized a little bit of your ideas about
how
to promote women in aviation.
More or less, they weren't carrying flags high and all that kind of stuff, and weren't really cohesive as a group in promoting anything in particular. It was just that
the Arden Women
there
Aviators.
There were a group of people who had the same enjoyment and pleasure out of aviation. I don't know that the 99s really made any impact any more than they do still on helping anybody to get a job or influencing legislation or anything else.
Still depend upon the women that were the leaders, you and the young people that started.
Well, it wasn't just one of those gung-ho things like the DAR, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Marjorie Brown?
Quite well.
She had a lot of fun.
Go-getter.
I like those articles she wrote. I don't know if you've ever read any of them, but I think they were quite terrific. It was nice to know that women were feeling, of course, you forget, women forget today, they think that they originated all these ideas, and they were the first ones to feel that women wanted liberty. But she's writing those sentiments, so many of which are being expressed today, about that feeling of togetherness and one for all and working together. And she seemed to take some leadership role for a little while, just in writing those articles, I guess.
Well, it, of course, that was an individual effort. As almost all 99 contributions were for so long, it was just simply individual efforts and not an organizational effort. In later years, there's been more real organizational activity than there was for a long, long time. And it's something that sort of holds women pilots together, and particularly today. And it was a good thing.
Who were the women that were that you would characterize as the leaders? And Amelia. Lady Mary Heath.
Mm-hmm.
we're really working for women liberation, women finding a place in aviation.
Well, I suppose as far as individual effort goes, Lady Mary Heath and Amelia probably had more influence and impact than any other women did. Except for the very early ones, Bruce Wall.
They had impact on a national scale, but there were women, just when you talk about Marjorie Brown, let's say, writing those articles, that exhibited her leadership qualities. I mean, she was working for more than just herself. And were there other women working to try and promote a place for women in aviation?
Well, I think almost every... the majority of the women were making contributions in their own way and similar ways. But not as well publicized as some. But probably within their circle of influence, just as important.
It's kind of a shared responsibility, though. You would also do what you could.
I think everybody was, to the limit of what they could do.
So we have two chapters in there. Find something to... Well, the Leadership for Women in 99.
Ruth Nichols should be along with Amelia Earhart, I think, and Marjorie Brown and that type who most people knew were making strides in the direction of women being accepted. Ruth did a tremendous amount of work that way with her efforts with the Aviation Country Clubs and later on with what was it called?
Service that she's formed to.
Yeah, I can't think of the name.
I mean, there's a piece that was service that she formed for ambulance.
Yeah.
No, I have it listed somewhere, written down somewhere. I thought it was funny in England, the woman had, I forget the woman's name, a woman in England had started the Aero Club over there, the big Aero Club in England. She was their founder. And then the British, they banned women from joining the club, and then women couldn't join that club until, I think, in the 40s, just ludicrous.
I mean,
have a woman as a founder and then to, you know, shut women out completely, became only a man's organization. I think Lady Mary Heath must have been quite a character. I've been reading a lot about her.
She must have been.
Did you know her at all?
I met her, and that's all.
She carries that kind of person.
And she must have been quite a girl. She was supposed to fly the 29 Derby, but she couldn't get an airplane.
Now, she was a very outstanding woman. She was bright and she didn't so much set records as fly around the world and do that kind of long-distance flying.
No, she was just active.
I wanted to, both Helen Ritchie and Ruth Nichols had at one point been airline pilots for airline. Remember that story about Helen Ritchie being, you know, cut out of her job by the male pilot. And Ruth Nichols was also one. She was the first woman airline pilot.
wasn't a schedule at all.
What about Helen Mitchell?
That was a schedule at all, and Helen really was the first woman airline pilot in the United States. Lady Mary Heath flew as co-pilot in a scheduled airline in England for a
while.
Before Ritchie.
There was an example of, even though men were helpful in aviation, and they were helping, you know, of men getting you, there was a chance for women to really get a head start in aviation, and they were cutting you out. And there was a lot of resentment about that.
There was. That was a dirty deal.
How long was Janelle about?
I think only about 6 months, a year at the most. They finally, the Airline Pilots Association, which still is in existence, finally, they wouldn't let her join in the first place. They wouldn't let her be a member.
And then they...
I didn't even notice. And then they finally decided that they pressured the line she was with that they wouldn't allow her to fly in bad weather. And
isn't that infuriating? That's just mean. It's just
people
so
were so
unfair.
Mad. Even some of the men were mad at the just the rank injustice of
it. Must have been articles probably I can find on that.
Well, when that happened, Helen said, "Well, what the heck is it?" And literally, they just pushed her out. They made it just untenable.
Was that before, was Amelia still alive at that time?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Must have made her angry, and he left it.
Oh, right.
Because she and Helen were good friends, and they were flying together.
Mm-hmm.
That's sad, but then the airmarking program came up shortly after that.
Well, the airmarking program was in being during that time.
Did you start the airmarking program?
Well, yeah, Phoebe Elmer. We got on as one of the women who pilots.
So we've come to the convention.
Where Gal was about to start today.
Oh.
Well, you know,
well, this is what I was.
She was trying to make a living out of aviation, and it's hard to do.
You know, following the stories, and again, I've done the research over the past 2 days, and I've been able to follow them a lot better. It seems to me that the women that didn't live a regular life didn't combine, as you did, their careers and marriage, so that they had that something, extra support there. That the pressures of that kind of life and the insecurities of it for a woman at that time, their lives all turned out tragically. I mean, it didn't turn out well. They just were harder down that on the luck of Lady Mary Heath sort of wound up. And she was eventually, she died. She was very seriously injured in one of those races. I forget which race it was. Was it a powerful? No, she didn't enter.
No, it was some...
Some big race. I thought it was the powerful Puff Derby, but...
No, I think it was one of those England and Australia races they were having.
And then she never really quite recovered from that. But all the women that didn't have that other kind of support seemed to just have a little bit of... and that tragedy. I mean, at least you had the warmth and support in aviation of your friends and camaraderie, but when it ended, it wasn't... Because it ended fairly abruptly. It didn't really last that long. But then you didn't have anything. I mean, if you hadn't... Like Laura Ingalls, I mean, of course, she must have been a bit eccentric all the time. But,
Well,
of course,
Laura had money, too.
Yeah.
Which,
Well, she said that during one of the articles that her parents had stopped supporting her. She'd lost a lot of money because of they wouldn't give her any more money because of her aviation export. They really wouldn't have too much to do with it. But that's sad. And, you know, today you can survive. Today you could survive a lot better. But in those days, you see, they were doing what they wanted to do and didn't necessarily lock many of them up for marriage. But they were destroyed because of that in a way. And the story doesn't have totally a happy ending. Which is how it changed.
Well, it's certainly been a long, hard road that women have followed. And just within the past 2 years, have the doors really kind of opened. Mm-hmm. And think how long it's been.
Yeah, I think about it. You know, what if I were living
back
in those days?
Talk about uphill fights.
I know. You don't quite, can't quite conceive of what it must have been like in order to be free, and not to really be free in the sense of being able to do what you want to do. We lived in so primitively. Really.
I hadn't looked at it that way, but...
I could find the fact that Ruth Nichols, after having a glorious life, she had a glorious life. 60% of it, certainly in the heyday of aviation, she did, right? She was very well respected, she was famous. Did any of these women at any time earn a lot of money from their export? Ruth Nichols made $250,000 for him, or something like that. Not Ruth Nichols, Ruth Elder, from her fight across the Atlantic. She did. I read that, but she lost it all eventually. But you couldn't make a lot of money.
Well, I don't know, but I would doubt that. But we've made $250,000 out of that time.
Well, through commercial tours, and she came back.
Well, she only did one that I know of.
Well, then you couldn't really make money. It was kind of always a struggle to survive.
But you were lucky if you could pay the expenses.
From Harriet Quimby, who wrote articles, right on down the line, but to Nancy Love, from the beginning to the end, Nancy Love, all of those women expected absolutely that there'll be a place for women in aviation. There's so many more uses for aviation. There'll be so many jobs. Women will definitely have jobs in aviation. It absolutely didn't happen. And every last one of them thought that it would.
Well, hope springs eternal.
But it just, they all were doing this with the expectation, so that must have been...
Well, basically, you were doing it because you loved it for a while.
Yeah.
And if you could make a living at it, so much the better.
Weren't you surprised? I mean, did you see the changes coming? You saw the changes in aviation coming? And you begin to suspect that maybe you weren't going to be jobs for you. You didn't perhaps care.
No,
you were going to give it up.
I don't. Well, you were always hoping that things were going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, very gradually they were. But it was very gradually. Sort of the snail's pace.
But you see, it seems to me that the best chance that women had to get into aviation was when they were in the eye of the public, when they were doing all these great things and were really proving themselves, that people came to accept them in aviation. After that died
But not professionally.
Yeah. Because they didn't accept them in any area professionally.
That's right. Look at what a hard time women had cracking the medical profession.
But at least the women doctors could, especially if they could get a chance to crack
the medical profession and the aviation were almost parallel. It was even hard for women to get into medical school, for a long time. It's hard for women to get into engineering school. They lose in engineering school. It was just that taboo when it came to, particularly in the scientific categories and the technologies, that there was a barrier that had been built a long time ago, and it was a man's world, and it was going to stay a man's world.
Right, there's a very statistical study a couple of months ago on people's attitude about crime and things, and they asked them, many women, would you find crime with a woman, but with a partner? And the majority of the women said no. And there were more men who said yes, they would, and they were a woman.
Is that right?
Said yes, yeah. There's still that thing. Yeah. Of course, you would find a crime with a woman partner because you saw that she damn well was the best part of all in order to have gotten where she was. Anyway, so let's talk about Amelia a little bit as a leader. You know, you and I have talked about them a lot. There's still some of the problems in the world that we're not very concerned. She was the foremost leader also because she was the foremost personality.
Well, Amelia was kind of inclined that way anyway. You can tell from her background that she would be a crusader for women in whatever area interested her most. So it was natural that when the turn of events took the turn they did, which was all happenstance, as it happened to so many of us, we just sort of all of a sudden fell into something that with the prestige that she developed and the public recognition that she would be as effective as she was in her crusade, if you want to call it that, of trying to get women accepted into the aviation world, on the ground as well as in the air. So because of the type of person she was and her background and her intelligence and personality and perseverance, she made, I think, a greater contribution than any other women into helping open doors. Other women, I'm sure, time and energy and thought as Amelia had, but didn't make the impact because of the advantages that Amelia had because of her name.
Mm-hmm.
There were others who were angels in her way.
Yeah, because she certainly spoke out and see the articles I can find the articles that she wrote.
And Marjorie Brown and her way.
Before any remarkable person?
No, she was very eccentric. And very, she wasn't outgoing at all. She was a loner.
Mm.
I think that's the best way to describe it. Very independent.
And a terrific
one. Terrific.
She spoiled herself a little bit, but I think you told me that she would be claiming that she's going to do something rather than to point in the not concrete.
I think I said that.
Did you follow that thing when she was arrested? Were you surprised? Well, you must have been surprised, but you couldn't really. out of all the women, or of all the potters, maybe not that it was Laura Ingalls.
Well, that was, and a lot of, in fact, a lot of people were. They were just aghast that such a severe penalty would have been slapped on the curb.
Do you think that she was really a German agent? I mean, you followed it, you don't think so. The newspapers, what I've gotten from the newspapers,
she just had a strong conviction that she didn't think the United States should get involved, like a lot of people did. But as the saying goes, she put her money where her mouth was.
But she did, in newspapers, they say that she did meet with Miss Drummond, that she did promote Hitler, that she...
Oh, that was a lot of hogwash.
Well, that's really bad if she got put in jail. Of course, in those days, they were really careful. I mean, she was lucky she didn't get quietly put away.
There was a lot of hysteria at that particular time.
Well, but I know that the British, disappeared after that.
Well, the most I was could figure was they were just trying to make an example of somebody, and Laura just happened to be it.
Of course, in 38, she dropped the pamphlets over to Washington, D.C.
That did it.
Yeah, and that contributed greatly to her. The evidence was back to her against her.
Well, that was the excuse they used to put her in jail.
Well, no. That was in 38, and in 41, that's when she was arrested for being a German agent. 38, her license, they suspended her license. They made the whole thing about why they were suspending her license, and that she had to go and take all these tests. That's when she really aroused everyone's suspicions, and they must have watched her very carefully after that. They must have really been right on her case there. They probably were spying on her right after she did that thing, and then that's how they, found out about her being with these Germans. I'm sure that she wasn't. But I'm going to find out.
That's a face that I don't know anything about, and I've never heard it.
I'm going to get these FBI
members.
That'd
be very interesting.
Yes, I think so. She'd be really interesting to tell. Mm-hmm. If you do think that she probably wasn't really a German spy, and I'll look over all the material very carefully. See, I just got...
Well, I don't think so, but that's just simply an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she was.
Well, now the air marking program you took in Helen Ritchie, and that was in what year was that? In the city? That lasted a very long time. With your involvement, all of your...
Well, I went up there in 34 and developed the program in Washington at the Department of Commerce. And I think that took about 6 months. And then we started getting in the original air marking pilots, and Ellen McCloskey and Nancy Love. And I was the first of the air marking pilots, and then we took on Helen Ritchie. And then in 1936, we took on Blanche Norris, who was the last of the air marking pilots, and the only one to stay. Civilian airplanes, and you navigated by pilotage, that is, looking down at the ground and using a map for reference to find out where you were. And it was not unusual to get slightly disoriented once in a while.
I love that story you told. What did that blessing read that you told? I think it must have been in your book. You said that you told, you assured her that it was
Ann
Boston
Town,
don't worry about it, and
yeah, and it was Lydia, you pick them.
Oh, and what happened? It wasn't Ann, you had made a mistake with Town, wasn't it?
Well, Standard Oil, some of the oil companies had done some air marking of roof, and Blanche put a travel air in the building the same as I did, so we met at the travel air factory, and she was had never flown west, and I told her all not to worry that there were, you know, air markers every now and then, and especially around the Los Angeles area, which was all cluttered up and hard to find your way around there, and there'd be signs on the roof. And so Blanche got confused and finally started some marking on the roof, and said, "Glory be, here's the air marker," and flew down, and it said, "Lydia E. Pinkham, vegetable compound." So we used to have to buzz railroad stations and try to read the name of the town on the railroad station, and that's a little hazardous.
Oh, yeah.
Also, it's hard to see them because it was usually over a roof overhang. Well, of course, she didn't do too much night flying in those days. So it was during the WPA days when, you know, they were making jobs for people. So somebody got the bright idea that maybe the government should put in air markers, more air markers around, and get the WPA to furnish the paint and the manpower to do it, instead of having them dig ditches here and there. And we worked with the WPA people in each state to get these air markers put in. We'd sit out the towns. And
the government called you in and asked you to take care of the program?
Yeah, the Bureau of Air Traffic. So it was a lot easier to spot a sign on the roof than it was to have to zoom a roof.
Let me just check one thing before we begin. I just want to make, I always have to check periodically if the voice is coming right. Because
a bunch of sandbags with 50 pounds of sand apiece, and put them in, we started off with 200 pounds overweight with sandbags in the front cockpit, and I took off, and everything went fine, and came back and landed, and we put another 200 pounds in, and I took off all right, and came back and landed, and we put another 200 pounds in, and did the same thing, and got up to 500 pounds overweight, and I took off, and everything was all right, and came back and landed. And then it suddenly occurred to us that I was having to land overloaded as well as take off overloaded. And at that time, the landing gear had the two struts were connected, were floated free, except in the middle there were shock cords made out of rubber that, you know, let the landing gear, you know, come and go with the bumps and bounces in the, on the fields. And the more weight you put on it, well, the further the wheels would go out. And so somebody noticed when I landed with that 500 pounds overweight. just hoped that it would take off the other 300 more pounds that we didn't put in the airplane.
And then you didn't, and then you...
It took off, all right.
And you landed.
But of course I landed empty, so...
So it didn't have to stand.
Yeah.
How many hours was your solo duration?
22 or something.
That was a woman's record?
Mm-hmm.
When did they stop having women's records today?
Oh, they never had it.
Oh. I thought that they eventually would, but women would sometimes beat the men, they would just break the men's record. All the time that you, in between the things that you were doing, you did a few endurance and races that are so long duration. What were you doing? Got a fine for Beechcraft?
I was with the Pacific Coast Distributor for Travelers, so in between I was doing the regular jobs. By that time I was demonstrating, I was selling and helping here, there, and everywhere, including bookkeeping and all the rest of it. But I graduated from having to sell tickets online.
That was good.
Well, cut that off again now. Let me read some more, and then we'll have another. What all did you get out of Eleanor Smith? Have you gotten enough to...
Well, you see, yes, in fact, that part about GP isn't mainly based on Eleanor Smith. Lucky for me that I got that interview with her, she was the honest, when she started really deciding not to, She felt comfortable and she was trusting me and she hadn't quite made up her mind that she was going to, maybe she oughtn't to be telling me these things. She made that decision a little bit later on, but it was a little too late. And I don't think, when did she realize the tape recorder at that time? No, I mean, that's right, but I don't think that she realized.
Well, if the song shut it off, then we'd get ready to do it.
Oh, we will. Wait 1 second, because I'm going to have to start asking something. So she was very upfront with me. This newspaper man, who came to see me and spoke, very charming guy. He came right out, did I tell you this, and told me, I asked him about GP and Amelia, and he came right out and said, it was right under there. He said, GP killed Amelia. He said, he killed her. He was responsible for her death. He said, and all the people that really were in aviation and were close to what was going on knew that he was really responsible for her death. That was the strongest statement. I mean, that's a very strong thing.
Especially from a newspaper man.
And he said he wouldn't be averse to saying that either if he was going to be on ground. He wouldn't be averse to saying that. Faye Wells also, I'm not sure you that question, because I sort of wish that she was here.
I take it she didn't get up for the weekend. Faye didn't.
No, she was going to come and call you if she did. She was okay. We'll try and hear another time. But, so let's talk a little bit about Amelia and GP. And let's just go over a little bit about what you think was happening. In those preceding years before, Bush took off and went on around the world, did you get to see her very much? Did you see each other?
Yes, well,
you did. Because you were very close. What year did she marry GP? Before her flight across the Atlantic solo, which was in 32.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
Well, it must have been the year prior to it.
And she didn't want to get married. I mean, she didn't really want to marry anybody. She just had a general feeling. She'd rather be free of herself.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. Amelia was not against marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But, I told her over the phone one time, I think that, she was terribly in love with the Navy man who was an awfully nice person, and Amelia was was cognizant of the place she, in which the public held her, you know, the esteem that they had for her. And she felt a sort of a moral responsibility to them. That isn't quite the right word, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. And she felt that when she did marry, that it should be a name person, a person with stature in the public view. And I'm sure that, well, I'm not sure, but I think that's the reason she didn't go ahead and marry this Navy.
Was he an officer in the Navy?
Mm-hmm. He was an aeronautical engineer and also a pilot.
Oh.
And just a piece of a guy, they used to, Herb and I were living in Pittsburgh at the time, and they used to fly down there every once in a while and pick us up to go off on weekends somewhere so that they could be duly chaperoned and things like that. And so after the friendship flight, of course, GP just took over Amelia and managed her, and
did she break with Navy Federal, or was she still seeing him?
No, she was still seeing Carl. But he, of course, GP was married at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally divorced his wife, who was a very charming lady, and put more and more pressure on Amelia to marry him.
What about the story that he was going to be let go from the publishing house, even though his uncle owned it, and he said that her marrying him would save him from that, and that she really owed it to him? I don't know.
Well, about that, I don't know. Did Faye say that?
No, I think I
did. Well, I know that well, he still was with the publishing outfit at that at this particular time. But I don't know what the inner workings of it were. And Amelia felt a certain obligation to GP because he had made it possible for her to make the friendship flight. And he had open opportunities for her book and public appearances and all that sort of thing. And getting on with the magazine and various and sundry things. And one night, our paths crossed to some hotel somewhere, and Amelia had to finally talk to somebody, so she was talking to me about whether, about all this marriage thing, which apparently was worrying her considerably, and whether she should, she felt like she should be married. Number one, she felt like it. She had come to a point where she shouldn't be married. She talked about the really extreme pressure GP was putting on her. And in fact, he, I think, very bluntly put it as an obligation that she owed him, you know. And she didn't know what to do. So the next thing I knew, they'd gotten married.
But what about the son, Carl?
Well, he just got written off.
Do you ever know what happened to him?
No, I don't. So, actually, it was a marriage of convenience, I suppose you can call it. Really, and it's only just my opinion, I don't think GP was madly in love with AE, and I'm sure AE was not in love with GP. I think she liked him, but she didn't love him. And I think it was with the understanding that she could just go on the way she had been, which I'm sure suited GP just fine, because after they were married, he just took a movie over whole hog and managed everything and did a lot of dictating to her, I'm sure. And there were times, I know, when she very much regretted her decision, but also divorce as far as, or even separation as far as she was concerned, was absolutely out of the question for the same reason that she married him. Because she felt like it would be an improper thing to do because of the esteem people have for her. So to all outward appearances, they had a very successful marriage as far as the outside world is concerned, which is the way Amelia wanted it. And I'm sure GP did too, although sometimes I thought he could care less. Well, he had what? He was riding Amelia's coattails. He was a publicity speaker. And had to be at the top of the heap. And Amelia was the way to get there and stay there. Mm-hmm. I mean, even that first shot out of the box when she made the solo flight over to England, he was there, and you would think he had made the flight. You know, he was in everything. And then later on at the White House, every door that was open to AE, there was GP.
Nobody liked him. I mean, nobody
liked
him at all. What he would
think. He was snobbish and self-centered and knew more about more than anybody else. He could do no wrong. He was, in his own mind, terrifically sophisticated and, you know, was a great guy. And he had a very dim view of women powers, very dim. Except he liked me. We got along fine together. But he was...
You could have raised him to be a pilot. And here he was he was promoting her to us.
Well,
guys, because he,
everyone except me.
Do you think that there's any credence to Amelia's statement that the GP tried to interfere with her career and she would nominate the best woman of God every year?
And she got the Harmon Trophy.
And also, was that being nominated the best woman of God over Amelia and everyone else? But he really, this infuriated him. Do you think that he would have been the kind of man that would have tried to interfere with her career or anybody else?
Oh, I don't doubt it if it would have met any added prestige or more money in his pocket. He was not a very honest person. I mean, he'd do anything to further himself, which was one of the most objectionable things about him, I think. And everybody knew it. I mean, everybody knew the kind of person he was, and it came out so obviously after he and Amelia were married that it was just almost nauseating. It was, but you would never know. I mean, outwardly, Amelia kept up just a wonderful front. But the climax was when the GP fired Paul Mance, when Amelia was getting ready to go on her second attack.
Why did he do that?
Well, he just got mad at him for some reason. I don't know why. And maybe part of it was money, because...
Now, Paul Mance was going to be the navigator, and
no, he was Amelia's advisor, technical advisor. And he trained her for the flight and saw that the airplane was equipped the way it should be and flew the way it should. You know, technical and all that. Mm-hmm. And that's all there was to it. They were good friends, but that was all. And in that movie, they had them about to have a love affair or something, and it was very far-fetched. Anyway, Amelia was very dependent on Paul for all of the technical stuff connected with the flight, and there was certainly a lot of it. Not only with the airplane and the equipment, but in setting up all the facilities around and stocking them with certain parts that he felt he might need, you know, for replacements, and helping her with her navigation in spite of the fact that she had a navigator along. He was indispensable. Well, to pay for the enormous cost of the flight, Amelia was to write the book, and it was to be all ready to publish as soon as she landed back in Oakland. She was sending it back as she flew, and then GP was editing it and getting it all ready. And then they had all these lecture tours set up and all that kind of thing.
But they registered GP, then took all the technical things.
So when the first flight flubbed, then they didn't have that money coming in. And so they had all the expense of getting ready for the second one, and I'm sure that they were strapped for money. People thought GP had a lot of money, but he didn't. He didn't have any money at all. So I think another reason that he fired Paul was because of the cost of Paul, which I think was running about $2,000 a month. Paul offered to go on and surf for nothing. He was just most distressed because he knew GP couldn't handle it. He knew all the things that had to be done, all the things that had to be coordinated. But GP had gotten mad at him about something and just said, "Goodbye, Paul, you're out."
And what did he do? And GP couldn't do it?
Well, of course he did, but pretty good. But not 100%. And I think she was so exhausted, so tired after having to scrub the first attempt, and then coming back and saying that the airplane got itself fixed up again, and worrying about money, and having GP on her neck all the time. I think she was just literally, physically exhausted, and when you get that way, you get mentally exhausted too. And I think she just got tired bucking GP. And I think it's another reason why she made a very grievous mistake in deciding to leave the trailing antenna at in Miami. And of course, another error which she realized, the Newman realized, and Paul Mance realized, is which is why he insisted on the low frequency trailing antenna so they could voice communicate over long distances. Mm-hmm. Because neither of them, you know, Newman could read code.
So that they couldn't even speak.
Yeah. And the trip itself, going the other way around, they had worse weather than they normally would have. As a matter of fact, the media did not want to go on that second. She wanted to wait a year and go the way they had planned it.
So, she was explaining to him behind because she said, and that was part of their story.
Well, I don't know whether it was contributory to her utter patterns, and I think she got to the point where she just didn't hardly give a damn, which is why she let him talk her into going ahead and reversing the route. Instead of waiting a year, they should have waited. Everything was in her favor. The short hop from Honolulu to Alpham Island. And they would have had enough passport had they not been able to find a pickup and gotten back to Honolulu.
Wait a second. I have to get this straight. Well, you said they chose the training kind of the low frequency radio. She had the low frequency radio with her, which didn't work very well with that training antenna.
She couldn't get that the distance. She couldn't get
right.
The distance.
Okay. But Paul Mance really insisted that she take the training antenna, but she got
because neither one of them could read Morse.
Now, the first time she took off, right? The first time from California. How did she go? How would trip go? California to
Honolulu
and then to
Havana.
And that would have been the trip?
New Zealand. It was just, she just reversed every stop that she would have made.
And then she would always
go
in
the other
direction. And the way this was the way you didn't happen to her.
Which was a tremendous distance. And Helen Island is the pancake in the Pacific. It's a little coral atoll that's about 6 miles long, or about 4 miles wide, something like that. And at high tide, it's only about 8 or 10 feet above sea level. It's just a fundamental noise.
It's a bad trip, actually. She wanted to wait a year and go on the same route.
Go to the same route they
had. Right. And then what happened? Did you keep that button?
No, we're running out of money. We have to make the flight. Amanda was a very sensible pilot. On all the flights she made, she weighed the risk looked like they were against her, she wouldn't make it. If look, the scales were balanced in her favor, then she'd go. Well, they were balanced in her favor if they had gone the way they were originally they had planned.
Now, we should go that way anyway on the second time around.
Because it was too late in the year and the weather was in the
place. But she might be able to make it going the other way with them weather-wise.
The weather wasn't so good, but it was better than they perceived on the verge of it.
Well, don't you think so? Maybe in that challenge kind of thing, she still had to consider what new things about it. So giving that challenge and taking behind it, in a way, she must have realized the importance of it. Why do you think it was? It seems like a wedding.
I just can imagine her not appreciating the importance of it. But she was concerned about one. And having made the number of bonuses by student before that, she knew how tired she got. And I think she was afraid she would forget to reel it in and have fun with the frail wire antenna. And a number of times when I've forgotten to reel it in. And when you want in, it's just a long wire. It has a big kind of a chain-up thing on it, and to hold the wire straight while you're in the air. And when you land, of course, that thing catches, and then the wire all stops up, and you have a mess in the things with the antenna.
Yeah, we have to deal with that.
Even by hand.
So I still didn't find myself even said that she thought that the case was beyond all of her, that there that I'm just sick and tired of talking, sick and tired of unbelieving. And she didn't hate to be treating me anything for me, so that's what he said.
No. It was installed.
Oh.
And she can't take that.
Oh, she did it. Well, I think she left because she was, oh, that's different. It was a big thing.
It was a big that took up room in the car. It was a big room. It took up room in the cockpit, and it was one more thing to think about.
Oh, man, wouldn't be like I did that at the end. That was just a classic thing. I hate that thing to be like, oh, my God, you got me that back all the time.
GP was supposed to coordinate with the Navy and the Coast Guard who had two boats stationed on half an island to send up video signals to help them do the lighter gathering. And GP was supposed to coordinate what Amelia was sending on and what they'd be receiving on and what they were sending on and what Amelia would be receiving on the frequency, radio frequency. And he flung the dub on there. And that was what did
it.
That was what did it. And I'll never forget him. Now,